you guys. At this time, we begin the TechNet. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB, Paul, WS2N, Hal, K60BZ. At Group of Four Guys, tries to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets here most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. The curious people meet here because they want to know how the stuff works, how to make it work better. There's a very loose schedule we've got where for the first hour we take questions and answers, somewhat brief, we say. At the end of that hour, we follow that with John, KC2WGB, who goes to the mailbag. Let me drop. I'm amazed how low that deep tone is. He goes to the mailbag for those who don't yet have the right equipment to sign in directly, and they send him email, snail mail, pigeon droppings, or whatever, and they give us a question. So he chooses a few of those that he thinks are of general interest. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, that tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing recently, and they're doing some good things. And along the way, Hal, K60PZ, will take his vast experience with a whole lot of ham radio equipment as well as other kinds of electronics and tell us what he believes is the right way to solve some of these problems. Right now, we're going to take check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in because you're listening. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. So give me your call letters and name right now. K2RAW.
SAW Bill, yes.
Okay, I heard SAW Bill. What was the prefix to that, Bill?
W2.
Hey, Whiskey 2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey. We got you, Bill. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WHYY Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. Anyone else? I think that was KC2RUA, and I think you said no. Your audio was very low, by the way. Did I get that correct, that you did say no?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. I do hear the four beeps in the background, but my goodness, are they low. Okay, let's start off with Bill, W2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey. Go ahead, Bill, K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. First, I want to start off with thanking you very much. Since I got my license about 2 years ago, I've been listening to the TechNet, and you've given me a lot of inspiration to build an antenna that I could use from within my apartment in the middle of Manhattan to make those DX contests. And strangely enough, I've had some success with not a Yagi or a dipole, but an 18-inch loop that I can talk on 10 through 17 meters quite easily. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on with my question. As I go ahead with developing my antenna, I'm building my own capacitors. And my question is, should I really be using brass in the capacitor to get the most out of it, or can I use regular zinc-plated nuts just as well? Thank you.
Okay, I think I understand the question, Bill. If I understand you correctly, 10 through 17 meters, you're using an 18-inch diameter loop, and you probably have a tuning capacitor at the end of that loop, and by changing the area of those plates or the spacing between the plates, you're able to tune the loop. Depending on how you make contact between the loop and those plates are fairly large in area, usually, and except for the point of contact, the actual conductivity of the metals wouldn't make a great deal of difference. You could use galvanized steel, aluminum, brass, copper. There's lots of things you could use there for those plates. And if you have any doubt about whether or not the materials you're using are too resistive, there's a very quick way you can find out. Put 10 to 100 watts into that antenna, key down for a couple of minutes, turn off the transmitter and go over there and touch everything. If it it's ice cold, you're home free. If it's hot to the touch, then it's wasting some power. There's a that's true of almost any kind of an antenna. No matter how you make, no matter how you make gimmick tuning capacitors and things like that, if you have any doubt as to whether or not you've got lossy materials in your antenna, the thermal test will tell you real fast. In fact, there was a series of articles in the Microwave Reflector, a listserv group of microwave enthusiasts that existed for the last 20 years or so, run by Tom Williams, WA1MBA. Dr. Williams has run this website and listserv, and one of the questions that was asked is, what's the real insertion loss of a UHF connector? Various people have put combinations of male and female UHF connectors in between a signal generator and a power meter, and they see the power go down by a certain amount. And if a person is real enthusiastic and a good fellow scientist, he starts cascading more and more of these UHF male and female connectors together. At first, the power goes down, then it starts coming back up again. Eventually, he realizes what he's doing is he's creating a trombone. The UHF connector has got a 35-ohm impedance, and you put that in the middle of a 50-ohm transmission line system. The signal generator is probably 50 ohms, and your power meter is probably 50 ohms. And so as your trombone, the length of UHF connectors, approaches one-half wavelength, the input impedance and the output impedance equal each other, and therefore what looks like loss really wasn't loss. It was reflection. Some of the signal, because of a standing wave ratio, because of the 35 ohms of mismatch, was being reflected back to the signal generator. And at certain lengths, it stops happening. So a thermal test is the real way to find out, is there true loss in anything? And if it runs ice cold and you still think you've got loss, then maybe you've got a standing wave ratio that's giving you reflected power back to the signal generator. Back to you, Bill.
Repeater, time out.
I hope I didn't. Looks like I didn't time out the Eastern repeater. W2SAW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you very much, Dick. That's all very good information, and I'm a little wary of trying that test, but apart from that, it sounds very good. Thank you.
Now, I wonder why you're wary of doing that test, Bill. It's a very good, it's a calorimetry test. The only way you can have true loss of something is it takes your valuable RF energy and turns it into heat. Now, as long as you're not locating your head in the middle of that loop, as long as it's some reasonable distance from you, like, say, 5 or 10 feet at least, when you're putting in, pick a number of 100 watts, it is a safe antenna. You're wary of doing the test for what reason, Bill? W2SAW, K2LAW?
I guess I'm not too sure, really. I don't like the idea of generating a signal for 10 minutes straight on any frequency, and I'm inside an apartment building, but apart from that, I guess there's no other reason.
I probably was stating it too strongly when I said 10 minutes. If your capacitor or any other component in an antenna is going to create heat, you're really going to know about it in 1 minute. So you run key down for 30 seconds or 1 minute, turn off the transmitter and go over there and touch everything. It'll tell you real fast. I mean, those plates of the capacitor that you're making probably have a thermal time constant of something like 30 seconds, so that you're going to get most of the heat you're going to get in the first 30 seconds or 1 minute. So it doesn't have to be a 10-minute test, because you're not heating up a pot of water. In other words, there's not a whole lot of mass to the materials that you're heating. And I think you've got a lot of freedom on the materials you could use for that capacitor. Roughly how big is that capacitor, and how do you adjust the placing, the spacing of those plates so that you hit resonance? Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by how big is the capacitor. You mean in picofarads or in size?
In size. Describe it to me. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've made some basically teardrop-shaped plates, which I put on two metal rods and space them with quarter-inch nuts.
Okay, if the nuts are giving them the spacing on the rods, I presume the rods are non-metallic. I mean, if you're trying to make a capacitor plate and you use metallic rods between the two plates, you'd have a short circuit. So, if I understand correctly, you've got a loop that's 18 inches in diameter. You're probably using a small loop or a gamma match to feed it from the coax cable. And at the far end of that loop, you've got some kind of a capacitor. In other words, you've got two plates that are close to each other, giving you some number of picofarads of capacitance. They're insulated from each other, and there's some method of adjusting that spacing. Give me a little bit of a description of how you did that, Bill. K2LIW.
Frequency ceiling.
Just real quick, you can see a photograph on my QRZ page, but they're two metal rods, quarter-inch threaded rods, and one of them rotates and one of them is stationary, and the one that rotates swings the plates inside the one that's stationary.
Yeah, Bill said to us earlier that he's doing this on 10 to 17 meters, and when you go to QRZ.com, you see this beautiful copper structure made out of copper tubing held up with PVC pipe in the window of his apartment. That's a good-looking antenna. Right now I'm having a little trouble picking out where the capacitor is. I'm guessing the capacitor is near the bottom where the... let's see now. Looks to me like you've got two turns to that loop. Most people do it with one turn. Very crafty. You did it with two turns. And the rods you're talking about, I presume, are plastic rods. Yeah, I think I see clear plastic rods that are holding the capacitor plates. We can all look at this by going to W2SAW and QRZ.com. Over to you, Bill. That's a nice-looking structure. Where'd you get the idea of how to build that? You got it, Bill.
There's actually three capacitors at the bottom there. One of them is the main tuning capacitor on the double loop, yes. And the other two, one is a shunt capacitor across the toroid, which is used as a pickup, and the other is in series with the hotline. And where did I get the idea? Listening to you, thank you very much, was the inspiration. And apart from that, reading the ARRL antenna handbook. And they are metal rods, because the two halves of the capacitor are otherwise completely isolated.
Okay, so you did use metal rods, but those metal rods, I presume, go down to a platform that is insulating material. Is that true? In other words, if I put my ohm meter between the two capacitor plates, other than the copper tubing, I wouldn't see ohms. Is that true?
That is correct, and actually they're built on a piece of plywood there.
Yeah, very crafty. So you're using that on 10 through 17 meters. Depending on how you feed it, depending on how you change the capacitor, that antenna could be made to work on 10 meters, 17 meters, 15 meters, 20 meters. You could use that for quite a number of frequencies. All you have to do is to change the capacitance enough so that your two turns of copper tubing hits resonance at the desired frequency. That's the number one criteria. And the number two criteria is the way you do impedance matching between the 50-ohm coax cable going into it and the actual copper tubing itself. So that concept for the antenna could be, with some difficulty, mechanical difficulty, you could use that all the way down to 80 meters, would you believe, Bill? All you have to do is make sure that that loop hits resonance, and it will do all the work you want it to do after that. The magic of an antenna, the missing piece of information in all of the antenna books, the missing piece of information in all of the courses you take in all the colleges that teach you RF engineering, the missing piece of information is resonate first, then it can radiate. Those are very simple words. It's not printed in any book that I know of. It's not given in any lecture that I know of. Over to you, Bill. W2SAW, K2RIW.
Well, that's what I've been listening to you say for 2 years, Dick, and that's what I followed, and that seems to be working. With this antenna, the one you're looking at there, it's only usable really through 10 through 17. The bandwidth would get really unusable if I went to 20 through 80. I did build a second loop, which you don't see there, that I used for 20 through 80 on a rather similar design.
Yeah, almost all loop antennas, unless you're at a high enough frequency where your loop is a good fraction of a wavelength in circumference, any fraction of a wavelength loop will almost always be quite narrowband. But that's not a showstopper. If you first tune it up for the low end of 20 meters and then change the capacitance so it tunes to the high end, you can use it across the whole darn band, not at once. You'll have to do some retuning. All of these loop-like antennas that are a small fraction of a wavelength are, by definition, high in Q, fairly narrow in bandwidth. That means you've got to be a little bit careful with the tuning, and you'll have to do some retuning when you QSY, but you'd be amazed what frequencies you can use these on. The Isotron antenna, a whole lot of years ago, and there's a whole lot of other compact antennas that use the philosophy you've got. And the exact physical layout is not as important as having enough area to the loop and hitting resonance. So, very well done. Alrighty, anybody else have any further questions for Bill, particularly if you've gone to QRZ.com and W2SAW and taken a look at his antenna, give me a call at us right now. K2LAW and the TechNet. One quick question I got for you, Bill. You're in an apartment building in New York City. Let's see now, I'm guessing you're in Manhattan. Double check that. Yes, you sure are on 25th Street in Manhattan. Your apartment building, your particular apartment, you're how many floors above the street, Bill? Go ahead.
I'm on the 8th floor, and I have about another 3 or 4 floors above me.
Very good. So the 8th floor probably puts you in the vicinity of 100 feet above the street. And give us a couple of hints. You've been using the antenna for how long, and what kind of DX have you either heard or worked so far on it? Bill, go ahead.
Okay, this latest evolution I've been using really for a couple of days, but yesterday I was able to, on 10 and 12 meters, make contact in the Netherlands, Italy, and Croatia. And on the 20-meter loop, I've also done Russia.
And all of that from the Marble Canyons of New York City. Well done. Oh, boy. I can tell you're having some fun with this one. So, as you can tell, whether the antenna is made out of $1 worth of materials or $1,000 worth of materials, and whether or not the manufacturer tells you it's got a gain of 1 dB or it got a gain of 12 dB. In some cases, he's fibbing when he says all those numbers. That's not what really counts. As long as it has a little bit of altitude, clears some local structures, and you're doing that with 8 floors, and as long as it hits resonance, that's the number one criteria, hit resonance. Number two criteria, give it a reasonable impedance match, not too low a standing wave ratio. In other words, the way you feed the coax cable into the loop, as long as that's got some kind of an adjustment to it, so that your favorite operating frequency, you can bring it down to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, a little bit lower. Maybe just by using a tuning antenna tuner, and you're on the air. Resonance and now altitude is one of the main things to make an antenna work well. Good luck with that, Bill, and come back from time to time and tell us what else you've heard with it. For a couple of days' use, you've already had some pretty good DX, as I see it. Okay, the next person on our list was Joe, W2LYY. How things with you, Joe? K2LYW and the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. How are you doing on the beach, Roy White? Okay, pretty good. Been getting on 10 meters in early in the morning, having some fun there on low bands. My question is related to an item that was used on some of the earlier Kenwood radios. I think it's an SM220, and it can be used for a couple of various different functions. Normally hooking up the transmitter through it, you can look at your modulation and so forth. That's a pretty easy thing to do. But my question related to that item, has anybody here within listing range of the TechNet ever taken that item and used a panoramic adapter function? Have they ever hooked that into a radio different than what it was initially intended for? Because SM-220 was initially intended for an older, much older series transceiver, and I'd like to use it on the TS-450 series transceiver, which is a much, much later transceiver than what it was originally set up for. I believe both radios use the first IF is the same frequency, like 8.3 megahertz. Anybody out there listening have any experience doing something like that, interfacing it to a later model radio than what was originally intended for? I think it was originally intended to work with like the TS-520, 820 series radios. I think initially that's what the thing was built for, let it come out in the late 70s, early 70s, early 80s type of radios. And the TS-450 came out like in the late 80s, early 90s.
DTZ with a comment. Go right ahead, Hal. And back off on the mic just a little bit. K60BZ, tell us about that FM-220. I presume that's the pad adapter. You got it, Hal. K2LAW.
Okay, the pad adapter, the SM-220, is a station-mounted scope and has the capabilities of a pad adapter, a BS-5 or a BS-8. Now, either one, depending, you could interface in all types of transceivers. What you have to do, though, is mix it to come down to the frequency of pan adapter frequency. Now, I don't have the manual on your radio you want to work with, but you mentioned that the first IF on your radio is the same as the TS-940.
Back off your microphone. Your audio is very distorted. Just back off a lot.
Hold on a second. It's on the wrong band for that.
Yeah, what he was saying, Hal, is he's trying to mate it up with a TS-450. He believes the FM-220 was designed for a TS-520, 820 series. Do you happen to know the IF frequencies of the pan adapter, or the IF frequency of a 520, for instance, versus a Kenwood TS-450? Maybe you just say you think mixing is going to be required. K6DPZ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is a comment also.
I heard a completely dead carrier for the last 45 seconds. That might have been you, Hal. Absolutely no audio on that one. While you're looking for which microphone is connected where, let's go over to John, who also has a comment, then I'm going to come back to Hal. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
2WGB. Dick, Rich has a comment, K2UPS.
Oh, go right ahead, Rich. And start off telling us what part of the country you're in right now. K2UPS, probably mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, K2UPS Mobile. The usual spot about this time every Sunday. Just came through West Virginia into Pennsylvania. My comment was on the loop antenna for W2SAW. A friend of mine just recently put one of those together. I think it's about a 36 diameter inch diameter loop, and he had it in the basement of his house yesterday, I believe, and on 20 meters, I think, made a contact into Russia with using only 5 watts. So those loop antennas are pretty amazing for what they can do. Back to you.
Yeah, well done, Rich. And what's hard to believe, a loop antenna is really a kind of a subset of the so-called infinitesimal dipole. By that I mean a real 80-meter dipole, for instance, would be made out of 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long, split in the middle with an edge insulator, maybe a balun, piece of 50-ohm coax going to it, and that's an antenna. And it works very well. Tune it to your favorite low-end, middle-end, or the high-end of the band by making it a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, and you'll be quite happy with that. You could, if you want to, take that 132 feet of wire, shrink it all the way down to 32 feet, for instance, maybe even 16 feet. And if you've got the right kind of an impedance matching device at the center of the antenna, quarter of the length, one-eighth of the length, one-tenth of the length of a normal dipole, it will be very high in Q. It will be very narrowband. Talk to anybody on 20 meters and they'll tell you that the small antenna, It's going to have a very small capture area. It's not going to hear much signal. Good sounding common sense. Not true. Let me drop it. The magic of resonance. Whether it's a full half-wave dipole and it's resonant at 80 meters, or whether you've made it super small, and by other electronic means you've forced it into resonance and a good impedance match, you'll get almost the exact same performance. As long as you're using low-loss materials, the infinitesimal dipole will never lose more than half a dB of gain compared to a full wavelength, full half-wave dipole. That's a hard one to believe. But it does that. It's the magic of resonance. The signal gets a chance to build up. It's going to be very narrow band when you make it small, but it's going to have the exact same capture area, the exact same gain, and the half a dB of loss is not loss. It's just that the normal figure eight pattern or the donut pattern gets a little bit fatter when the antenna is super short. That's where the half a dB went. You didn't even lose half a dB of gain, if you know what I mean. You lost half a dB of directivity. The donut became a little bit fatter. So loop antennas, as long as you're using them out of low-loss materials, and you can prove that real fast by running it, let me say for 1 minute. Key down for 1 minute, or maybe 30 seconds. Turn it off and go over there and touch everything. If everything's ice cold, you're radiating every bit of that signal, as long as you've got a reasonable standing wave ratio, and you can measure that separately, you're radiating every bit of that signal. The law of reciprocity says if the antenna works well on transmission, it has to work equally well on reception, and all that effective capture area is there. Yes, the very strong local magnetic field you get out of that small loop creates a great big cloud of magnetic field around the antenna. It reestablishes the effective area. That's a hard one to believe, but Mother Nature does that for you. Now, let's see if Hal is back, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about the FM220 pan adapter, Kenwood pan adapter. K60BZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is Angela Lee. I've also had a little question pertaining to those loops after you get through with this stuff. Angela Lee.
We're going to come back to you, Barry. Hal, you've got it now.
Yes, am I getting through okay?
Yes, you are. Tiny bit heavy on the audio. Back off a little bit on the mic, but you sound good.
Yeah, the BS8 and BS5 for the SM220, there were two different pan adapter boards, the 5 megacycle board and the 8 megacycle board. And basically, you can make that pan adapter work for many different first IF frequencies. The trick is you got to put it in on the first IF, not where it goes through any filtering, or else you're going to lose the ability of the pan adapter to give you a good broad bandwidth. I'm not sure offhand on the radio you're talking about, first IF. If you give me a call tomorrow, I'll pull a manual on your radio. I'll pull the manual on the pan adapters. We work on them. And I can give you more conclusive information. I just don't want to give the information off the cuff, so to speak. We do have all these books in the library because we service all these things. Go ahead, Dick. K2RIW, 60TZ.
Yeah, it does make sense that right after your very first mixer in the radio, at the input to your first IF stage, is where you want to connect the pan adapter because that's where you have the greatest bandwidth. Two or three stages downrange in the IF strip where it becomes very narrow, you're not going to be able to see very far above and below where you're tuned to on the pan adapter. And so, if I understand correctly now, the FM220, you can buy it or fix it or align it with the so-called 5 megacycle or 8 megacycle printed circuit board that you can plug into it. And assuming that his rig, which is a Kenwood TS450, assuming the 450 has either 5 or 8 megs, then using the right board will get you there. And even if you got the wrong board, if his TS450 happens to be an 8 meg radio, and he's got the pan adapter with the 5 meg IF, my guess is it wouldn't be too difficult to modify that PC board. If you haven't got a chance to get a hold of the right PC board, then I bet you there are ways, but even modifying the board so that it works correctly on 8 meg instead of 5, my guess is that wouldn't be rocket science. It's doable, is a guess on my part. But this back to Joe so far. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
More comments.
Now, let me pick up Joe first, just to make sure we're not way off to one side, and I'm going to go over to Hal in that order. Joe, go ahead.
Okay. I believe both radios have the same IF. I believe the IF is like an 8.3 meg IF. I know that's what it is in the TS-450 series radio. I think it was the same in the TS-520 and TS-820. Someone's around there, I think, so, you know. But what I don't know is I don't have a schematic on it, the 520, 820 series radios to know exactly where the pick-off point was, where they pulled that IF level signal from. I know if it was just right after the mixer, after one filter, or exactly where they pulled it from. That's why I was asking if anybody's had any experience with it, putting that on a later model radio, so I can put it on the right spot and get it to work, do the right thing, at the, you know, the right way without wrecking the radio.
K16DZ, you all heard the radio, pull the schematic on your 460, go right after the first mixer. Don't go through any filtering, just couple off with about 10 puffs, right into the standard adapter, and it should work fine. As long as the IF is what you said, you may have to tweak the standard adapter a little bit to get in the center, just a little bit of discrepancy, but it should work with no problem.
Okay, can you physically hold your mic further away from where you're talking instead of adjusting the radio? Can you do that? Because you're jumping out of the system. The motor's changing as you're talking on voice peaks, so you're over deviating.
Okay, I'll talk softer. Is that better?
That's better. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a whole lot better. So repeat that last message, Hal.
Got a schematic on your radio. Look to where your first mixer is. And you want to tap off with about 10 puffs off of your first mixer before it goes into the IF. And that's the best place. Don't want to go for any filtering, roofing filters, nothing. Right, coming off the mixer, I forgot what they use. I believe it's either a FET or a transistor. But go off that first mixer's output, very lightly couple, and you should get exactly what you want.
I used to own the Heathkit pan adapter. I did something very similar to that one, Joe. I think I used a 10 picofarad puff capacitor right off the mixer of my radio. Radio was using the time was an ICO. I think it was 455 KCIF. But you got something a heck of a lot better, more modern design with an 8 meg IF. And the nice thing about the 10 picofarads, it gives you enough signal without detuning that first IF stage. And maybe you touch up the tuning a little bit. And in the worst case, if the pan adapter doesn't see enough signal, to change the 10 picofarad to 50 picofarad is an easy thing to do. It'll just require a little bit more retuning, if you know what I mean. But the mixer output into the first IF stage is where you're going to be tapping. Your schematic on your 450 will show you where to do that. If you tap in the wrong place, it's not going to explode. You can always try a couple of different places, if you know what I mean. But as little filtering as possible is what you want, so you see the most amount of signal above and below where you're tuning. Back to you, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-L-A-W, the Tech Man.
Okay, very good. I have a schematic on the TS-450 series radios. I can definitely check that and see what look for an injection point. And I have to physically put a hole, I guess, in the back chassis to accommodate getting a cable out to go to the pan adapter, because there are jacks in the back, but the jacks are meant to go to another series of adapters for digital audio processing. I don't want to interrupt those, the pre-made factory wiring. So I should put another jack in the back someplace when I find some room. But okay, at least it gives me a good idea, a good direction to go in. And when I get the thing completed, I'll come back and let you know. May not be next week, but it'll be soon. WHYY.
As a guy who tunes to the TechNet a lot often, you can tell. Because I almost always, when somebody's doing something like this, I say, when you've done it, come back and let us know how well it worked. And so Joe anticipated that, so we already know that. Okay. We're doing pretty good on our schedule tonight. We've had two people who signed in with a question. Got to be somebody else out there with a question. So give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2FGU Mobile.
KD2. FTU Mobile. And by the way, I made the mistake of skipping over Barry and 2MB, who called in earlier. Let me go to Barry first. And to Mike Bravo, K2LAW. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay. Yes. When you were discussing the loop antennas, something came to mind that I've been rattling around for many years. I wanted an antenna for 75 meters that would have a very good front-to-back ratio. For reasons, of course, of working, listening to DX. And I have in the past, I wonder if anybody has ever done this. I want to have two loops on a boom. I guess they would be a quarter of a wave apart or something like that. And the one of the loops would be tuned to be a reflector. Has anybody ever done that on 75 meters? I don't need it for transmitting. It's only for receiving. And I think it would be a really good antenna for hearing DX and 2MB.
If you go to any of the articles on the subject of high-frequency direction finding, many of those direction finding antennas consist of a loop plus a monopole in the middle of the loop. And by properly phasing the monopole plus the loop, you do get a cardioid pattern, a heart-shaped pattern. In other words, there's a null in one direction, let's call it the back lobe. So it doesn't necessarily require a quarter wavelength of spacing. And the usual reflector that we put on our Yagi antennas is not a quarter wavelength away. I mean, it's not a half wavelength away. They're more in the vicinity of quarter wavelength or a little bit less. There's nothing magic about quarter wave in order to give you a cancellation in some direction. However, you do have to account for whatever distance that is. Across that distance, you're trying to generate a signal from two sources, the real antenna plus this extra device, which is 180 degrees out of phase and reasonably close to the same magnitude. And then you'll get a front-to-back ratio out of it. So the direction-finding antennas are one way to go. I know you can do it with two loops. It's just not the popular way it's done. The direction-finding antennas are usually a loop plus monopole, I believe. Some of you guys out there, I guarantee you've got some more smarts on this one than I do. Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. I heard somebody sign in with no audio. So, anybody out there have used any of these circuits on high-frequency direction finding? A loop antenna plus monopole. It's a loop plus another device, usually very closely spaced, but with proper tuning between the two, you do manage to get a null in one direction. Has anyone done that? Has anyone read some of those articles? Anyone understand the theory of operation? Tell us whatever you know right now. Give me your call letters, K2RIW and the TechNet. We're not getting very much contribution tonight. Normally, the New York City area, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, Long Island, eastern Connecticut, or western Connecticut, normally there's a lot of brain power in that area, and I assume you guys have done some direction finding. Maybe not. But if you simply Google the word direction finding antennas, high frequency direction finding antennas, I suspect there used to be a section on that in the Handbook for Radio Amateurs. I don't know if it's still there. I know there are manuals on the subject. I know there are articles on the subject. I know it's very doable. And the size of the loop is not critical. The loop is just there to hit resonance, so you get a reasonable receiving aperture. Resonance will do that for you. And now to make a null in one direction, a cardioid pattern, is what you're looking for. So one other radiating device of similar polarity will do that for you. If the loop is set up for vertical, then a vertical monopole, properly phased, I believe will do that. But as you can tell, I have not done it. Anybody have any further information? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, K6DTZ. When you're working with a loop, you work with a sense antenna. That will give you directivity on the loop antenna.
Okay, so you add a sense antenna to the loop antenna. Give us a few words on that. Is that sense antenna a monopole? What is the loop itself, we pretty much know how to build a loop. How do you add a sense antenna to it so that the loop antenna has a front-to-back ratio? Back to you, Hal, and make sure you're standing far enough from that microphone. K2RIW, back to you, Hal.
Just want to comment on that before Hal picks it up. I was told that to get maximum front-to-back ratio, that's mainly a function of the spacing between those two devices, and that you really can't change that. Over to Hal. and 2 MB.
Normally, with a high-frequency loop, the sense antenna is put in a phased in with the loop because it's a phasing network. Then the sense antenna will cancel one direction of the loop's reception where you'll have a null. I've done a lot of that stuff on the HF and low frequency, and I've done some experiments, you know, on VHF. It's a little touchy on VHF to make a loop with a sense, but the sense is vertical polarization, and the loop will circle with a whoop. It does work. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, one of the things that's kind of funny about a loop, the normal way of setting up a loop, you could, if you want to, make the variable capacitor that tunes the loop either at the top or the bottom of the loop, and you're feeding it on the opposite side. And under normal circumstances, that will make a vertically polarized loop, and the loop will have maximum signal reception in the plane of the loop, opposite of common sense. You would think it would have maximum reception perpendicular to the plane of the loop. If my loop was set up so that the plane of the loop is north-south, then it will be receiving signals north and south. And by adding this other device, this other monopole-like thing, properly coupled in, you can cancel the north or the south, if you know what I mean. Yes, there probably is a magic spacing and a magic way of tuning that other thing to give you the deepest null in one direction. But the articles on direction finding, HF direction finding, should tell us how to do this. And as you can tell, I haven't done it. Wonder what you've read so far on this one, Barry. N2 moon bounce? And are you trying to direction find on a source of QR Mary in your neighborhood? N2 moon bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Okay, actually, I've never made one. It's always been back of my mind, and it's for listening to DX, not necessarily to get rid of static, but to have a one-directional antenna so that you don't hear signals from every direction on 75 meters. That's the whole thing. And I have never done it. I've often thought about it, and I think I would like to bring this up at the next segment, see if anybody has more to add to it. But I am going to do some reading on it now. I didn't realize the way other people do it. In my mind, I always thought you just have two loops, you phase them, and you're good to go. But I guess you don't have to have two loops. You could have two anything. And that's where I never really actually thought about that. But people who have done this a lot, I guess that would have occurred to them. Back over to Net Control. It was very good. I got a lot of answers from this in 2MB.
Yeah, I'm making some guesses as to how your thinking was working on this one, Barry. You would have set the two loops up so that they're collinear with each other. In other words, the major axis of the loop, of each of the loops, would be along the same rod, so to speak. And if the loops were receiving the signal broadside, that would be the right thing to do. Now that you know that a loop antenna almost always receives in the plane of the loop, set the loop up, a vertically polarized loop, where the plane of the loop is north-south, it's going to receive maximum signal north and south. In the plane of the loop, not at right angles. Now, if you set up two loops side by side, as you can see, your second loop would be east or west of the main loop, so to speak, and therefore it's not going to give you the cancellation unless you offset the second loop by pushing one of them further north and one of them further south. And the second antenna to create the null doesn't have to be another loop. A monopole can do it. So I think that's the way it's usually done with direction finding. And as such, as we dig deeper into this, I think we're going to find something on that one. So you'll be reporting back to us as you do this further research, because what you're about to do, a lot of people want to do, just the people listening tonight haven't done it. We're now going to go over to Steve. I think it's Kilo Delta 2 Foxtrot Tango Uniform Mobile. Go right ahead, Steve, K2RIW, the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you very much, K2RIW. No, the call sign is Kilowatt Delta 2 Foxtrot Queen United Mobile. The name is John. I've checked in before. I'm just giving an update on a question I asked a couple of weeks ago about using a VX8DR antenna with a VX6 handset HT radio.
Go right ahead, John, and give us the further information.
Thank you very much. The Update is, I was able to test out the 220 side of that radio with the YHA-65, which is the BX-8DR's antenna for the U.S., and it was $29 from Yaesu directly. HRO has it on their website, but none are available in any of their stores. And for about 20 or probably 25 miles away, I was able to hit up, or at least make contact to WW's 220 side. And I was good. I was told 80% quieting, and I'm very happy about it. Also, the antenna has very good receive with the 6-meter attachment at the top. Let me let it drop. The antenna has very good receive for both 6-meter, 10-meter, with that little attachment for it, which extends it out just a tad bit.
So it sounds to me like you're happy with that arrangement. Now, what is different? I'm having a little bit of blank memory here, John. Tell us what you changed from the original equipment. You added another antenna, if I understand correctly, and you wanted to use this on 220. I vaguely remember that this is a tri-band antenna that you added. So assuming you're telling me for the first time, because I'm a super forgetful person, which is almost true. You got it, John. K2LIW.
KD2FQ. Thank you, Dick. The radio, well, the question was mods cap, the Mars cap modification for the VX6. I had a friend take care of it for me, but I haven't tested out the 6-meter side of it yet. But I was able to test the 220 with the different antenna. I lost the stock rubber duck that I had for this. And using this over like a Nanyo 701 2-meter 440 antenna I had, and forgot another HT rubber duck I had for the radio. But I have better receive with the stock Yaesu VX8DR's antenna, which is the YHA-65. Good receive for 6-meter, good receive for the 10-meter. I haven't listened on the 220, but 2-meter and 440 is awesome.
Glad to hear that you're doing so well on 10 and 6. 220 in this area, I believe, is not a super popular band. Not as bad, but probably a little bit like 10 gigahertz. On the 10 gigahertz band, if you decided to 2 o'clock in the afternoon call CQ and tell somebody, I'm on 10,368 megs, I'm calling CQ, and now I'm carefully tuning the band. Well, I laugh at that because the band is 500 megacycles wide. Of course, we all tune to the specific calling frequency, 10.368 gigahertz. Now, 220 is a little bit like that. During contests, during a VHF contest, you're going to see activity there. But if you've gotten used to the activity you see on 2-meter FM repeater mode, and you go over to 220, I'm not a 220 person, but the people that I talk to lead me to believe that, except for the pack rats, the Mount Airy VHF Society in the Philadelphia area, who use it as their private intercom frequency, so to speak, when they're passing, let me drop it. During contest, that club that consists of about 200 members is passing information back and forth on the 220 megacycle channel that they've all set up, FM. So it's sort of an intercom within their club. So except for that group, the 220 band is nowhere near as popular as 2 meters. So if you don't hear anything on 220 at first, don't be discouraged. It may be because in your neighborhood, which I think is, let's see, Brooklyn, although you're in the, if there's going to be any 220 area, you're in the right place. The Boston area, the Brooklyn area, and the Philadelphia area is where it's likely to be. So when you finally do hear somebody on 220, or when you, if you're on the 2-meter repeater and you say, is anybody on 220, so you can give me a signal. That's the best way to test out the system as I see it. You got to find somebody else who's on the band. And when you do, let us know what you find, John. KD2FQU, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. I do appreciate that information. I did get good results with the 220, but I'm still listening. I was able to make contact on Simplex for 2-meter household of other 220 repeaters, but I haven't tuned them up into my radio yet. I've been using mainly my mobile setup. But I'm going to say 73, and it was great. I will give another update with more action on the 220 in this area. So this is KD2FQU, K2RIW with the TechNet. Back to you.
When you're using the ARRL repeater directory, I'm reasonably sure you're going to find a number of repeaters that are listed for the Brooklyn, Manhattan, Staten Island, Queens area. And hopefully the repeater directory will tell you what is their offset, which is probably the typical offset, and what is the PL tone. And once you know that PL tone, you can see whether or not you're able to bring up those repeaters, particularly if you can choose one that is within, let me pick a number, 15 miles of your house. And depending on whether or not your antenna is high enough up and it's got clearance to the terrain, the possibility exists you can talk to that repeater from 50 miles, but with a handy-talkie, you're going to get much, much smaller range. So with the repeater directory, you'll find out what 220 repeater FM directory or repeater sites exist. And so I suspect that that's going to be a lot more popular than 2-meter simplex. And out of curiosity, I'm guessing your rig, your receiver, your transmitter is strictly FM. There is 220 megacycle, 221 megacycle single sideband, but I'll bet you that's quite a bit more rare than repeater FM operation. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
That's correct, Nick. That's correct, K2RIW, KD2FQU. It only pushes 1.5 watts, so if it is 220, and it's strictly FM, unlike the XADR that does 50 watts on 6-meter with full 1 watt on AM. My HT, nor do I have another HT or even a regular radio that does 220. That's the only one I have.
Mr. YDT, go right ahead.
Okay, so main 220 repeaters that I will. Great South Bay one, the Limewalk 220, and the W2 Zulu Lima Papar. Those are three 220 repeaters that are in this vicinity that work very well.
Yeah, I think that's Matt. That's good to know. I should have realized that, yes, this repeater group has a 220 repeater. Why the heck didn't I think about that? I'm looking up the repeater directory right now. I'm listening for the, sure enough, it's W2KPQ 224.82. 224.82 megahertz. 224.82. Offset is minus 1.6 megs. And it's located at Glen Oaks in Queens, so it's on the Queens-Nassau border. So there is a repeater on this frequency, and although it doesn't say so in my repeater directory, I am guessing that Limewalk is following their usual rule where the PL tone is probably 136.5 for ZPL. Anybody want to correct me on that one for the 224 repeater on Glen Oaks? K2LIW listening.
5 bands, that's what you need.
bring up a good point, Matt. Many of the 220 handy-talkies only run 1.5 watts, whereas a good high-power 2-meter handy-talkie runs 5 watts. 1.5 watts versus 5 watts, at first it sounds really bad, you know, a 3-to-1 ratio, so to speak, in power. And a naive person would say, you're only going to get 1/3 the range out of that. That's not the way it works. 3-to-1 ratio is 4.5 dB of power difference. And by the way, the inverse square law works. If you ran a careful range test at any one particular frequency, and you first do the range test at 5 watts, and then do the range test at 1.5 watts, I think you're going to find about a 50% difference in range, about a 3-to-1 difference in range, because of the way propagation and obstacles work and whatever. So don't be discouraged just because you got 1.5 watts and you think you're not worthy to be on the band, if you know what I mean. It's only 3.5 or 3.7 dB down, so it's not a showstopper. It's a little bit of a disadvantage. As you walk around your room and you're getting multipath bouncing of signals off of the various objects, the signal can easily go up and down 10, 15, 20 decibels very easily as you walk around the room. So your particular transmitter being 4.5 dB down, when you've got 15 or 20 dB of QSB just by walking around, as you can see, one dominates over the other. The positioning is much more important than the exact number of watts you put out. Okay, we've approached the time when we should be going over to the mailbag. And how tough were the questions this week, John? KC2 WGB, K2RW the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Good evening, Dick. All everyone around. The questions, we've got a couple of them. I think they're going to be easy ones. I don't think there's any stumpers. But I first have a question on a directional coupler.
Yeah, directional couplers are something that we covered quite a bit. I guess 1 week ago or 2 weeks ago. And it's a subject that has been very lightly covered in almost all of the amateur radio literature, amateur radio conversations, amateur radio classes. It's always a good subject. It's an extremely useful tool, passive, low expense, high-end performance. And so fire away with your questions. And by the way, I think you did find that I was hearing during the week that one of your directional couplers seems to be showing an awful lot of loss on the straight-through line. And one of the very first things I'd want to do is put an ohmmeter on there. Set a conductor input to output end on the straight-through line. Should be darn close to 0 ohms. If not, it's time to start finding out where the open circuit is, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Exactly, Dick. This is a 20 dB dual directional coupler. The couple ports from the center pins of those end connectors will measure 50 ohms to the frame. And by the way, this is made out of stainless steel. It's about a foot long and about 3 inches by 3 inches. Okay, it weighs about 8 pounds. This is a monster. Now, the through port has a 20 dB loss, which I found very unusual. It is extremely difficult to get this apart. I just wanted to touch base with you to see if this, it is marked directional coupler. So I just wanted to touch base with you to see if there would be any reason for that other than a broken through line or something wrong with that through connection.
Of all the directional couplers you own, John, Nada and other brand names, you've got some 6 dB, 10 dB, 20 dB, 50 dB directional couplers. The straight through line is, when RF is fed through it, a 50 ohm transmission line. With your ohm meter pin to pin, center conductor to center conductor, you should measure 0 ohms. From center conductor to ground, you should measure infinity ohms on any normal directional coupler. Now, if they've really made a resistor divider network, a hybrid-like divider network, and they call it directional coupler, and there's ways you can make that directional, and the fact that you're measuring 50 ohms from center conductor to ground with an ohm meter.
Coupled port, Dick.
Okay, coupled port is 50 ohms to ground. Straight through port, you did tell me straight through port, center pin to center pin is how many ohms, John? Go ahead.
It's open. No connection. It seems like it has a little capacitance effect, but there's no direct connection, and it has a 20 dB loss with the signal.
Right now, unless it's a very special device of some kind, it sounds like a defect. Something has come apart. Probably you've already done a good visual inspection of